May it please the court, my name is Grant Sullivan, registration number 40151. With me at council table is First Assistant Attorney General Eric Meyer. We represent the Colorado Department of Revenue. Although this case involves somewhat dry issues of tax administration, the department views this case as having the potential to significantly disrupt its well-developed system of income tax governance. That system is built upon the foundations of several interlocking state and federal statutes, and that system contemplates that the department possesses a specified amount of time from the filing of the annual income tax return to review the entirety of that return and to make corrections. The error committed by the district court below was that it viewed that system as donation-centric rather than return-centric.
Let me ask you, counsel, aren't there two statutes we have to be concerned with here, not just your general limitations period, but also your conservation easement credit statute?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe you're referring to Section 3922.522, subsection 7I.
And isn't that a little bit different kind of statute?
It is a different animal, Your Honor, and there's really three things I'd like to say about subsection 7I, if I could. First, if you read the text of 7I, it says nothing about either the length of the statute of limitations or the event that triggers the statute of limitations.
But it does say that the donor and the transferee share that same statute of limitations.
That's true, Your Honor. But even the donor, the TMR, is subject to federal law, the separate taxable unit rule. There is no authority for excluding CE donors from this body of federal law that Colorado has incorporated.
You're not trying to enforce federal law here, are you, counsel?
Your Honor, I do believe that Colorado's system is linked to the federal system. The General Statute of Limitations, 3921.107, links to federal law.
Right, but we're not compelled to follow the federal law. If the legislature decided not to follow federal law in a certain area, it could do so, couldn't it?
It certainly could, Your Honor, but here the legislature has expressed an intent to follow federal law in this case. And there are several...
Opposing counsel would argue contrary based on the conservation easement credit statute.
He does, Your Honor, in particular 7I. And let me get back to 7I again, because I do think that is what the plaintiffs in this case and what the district court hang its hat on primarily is 7I. So the first thing about 7I is that it doesn't tell us important information about the statute of limitations. For example, it doesn't tell us what the length of the statute of limitations is or what event triggers the statute of limitations. For that information, we look to other provisions which in turn link to federal law. Federal law says it's 3 years from the filing of the annual income tax return. And that has been meant to interpreted to mean that the separate taxable unit applies. Each return is the origin of a new tax liability, and the taxing authority possesses a specified amount of time to review the entirety of the return. The second thing I'd like to say about 7I is that it says the donor's limitation period controls. That's fine. But even the donor is subject to the separate taxable unit rule. There is no authority for excluding the donor from this body of federal law. Even the plaintiffs in their briefing concede that the separate taxable unit rule applies in certain instances. They say it applies to mathematical and clerical errors. But as we point out in our briefing, that it's simply just an untenable standard. It would lead to too many gray areas. As federal law holds, if a period is open for one purpose, it's open for all purposes, clerical and substantive. And the final thing I'd like to say about 7I...
Let me ask you, is there a provision at the federal level that looks like, smells like 7I?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor, but there are credits, deductions at the federal level that do look like these conservation easement tax credits.
Are there anything at the federal level that donors buying transferees and donors and transferees are subject to the same statute of limitations?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor, but there are other credits, deductions that can be carried forward for long periods of time. Net operating loss deductions are an example. They can be carried forward for 20 years. I do believe there are examples in the tax matters partner area where the tax matters partner is allowed to bind the partnership with certain decisions. So I do think there, it's not exactly on point, but there are examples in federal law where credits can be carried forward, deductions can be carried forward, and a designated person is the person that gets to bind larger groups with decisions about tax matters.
Counsel, as I understand your argument, it's kind of like, well, this, to interpret 7I as they wish would be just a disruption to the state tax system. Is that something you need to take up with the legislature? Or can you explain to us why 7I is consistent with your separate taxable unit?
Yes, Your Honor. The last thing I'd like to say about 7I is really about the text. The text says, the transferee shall be subject to the same statute of limitations with respect to the credit as the transferor of the credit. But other than the year of transfer, what we call the year of linkage, the transferor is not necessarily going to have a statute of limitations with respect to the credit. And the reason for that is the donor, and this happens very frequently, the donor can transfer away the entirety of the credit. So in years 2 through 100.
Why doesn't it suggest then that it starts with the donor? The statute of limitations commences with the donor.
It does for that year. For the first year, for the credit that he uses in that year, it does start there. But for credit that he uses in year 5, the statute of limitations does not start until year 5 and does not expire until year 9.
Let me ask you this, counsel. That seems to be a limitation that does not appear in the text of the statute. How do we read that into the statute?
It's necessary to look to other parts of the statute, Your Honor. And the reason for that is, again, 7I is not the end-all be-all. It doesn't tell us important, necessary information about the statute of limitations. We have to look to other provisions to know how long is the statute of limitations? What event triggers the statute of limitations? In other contexts, it's the party's knowledge of his right to a refund, his right to file a civil suit, that will trigger the statute of limitations. But in the tax context, which is unique, it's the event of filing the annual income tax return that triggers the statute of limitations. But 7I tells us nothing about that. We have to look to other provisions, specifically 3921.107, and that in turn adopts federal law, including the separate taxable unit rule. That's found in 26 U.S.C. 6501. It says it's the event of filing the annual income tax return that triggers the statute of limitations. Reading 7I in isolation by itself doesn't complete the picture. We don't know. Is it a one-year statute of limitations? Is it 3 year, 4 years, 24 years? We don't know. So we have to look to federal law.
Why can't the two statutes be read together to create essentially a four-year statute of limitations, but not based on separate taxable units, based on the initial claim of the credit by the donor?
Again, because it doesn't work with the rest of the system. If we have to look to other provisions, including 107, we also have to look to other provisions about the statutory protest procedure. I think that is very telling. Certainly if a donor files in year one, tries to claim a credit, that's not going to give rise, and then the department disallows it. That's not going to give rise to any exercisable protest rights. The statutory protest procedure only is triggered when there's a deficiency in tax. Either the department has asserted that there's a deficiency in the amount of tax owed, or there's been a rejection of a refund claim. Absent that, absent a live dispute about the amount of tax owed, there is no right to a hearing. And that is consistent with the federal system, with the U.S. Tax Court. You don't get a hearing in U.S. Tax Court unless there's a dispute, a live dispute, about the amount of tax owed. So I think all of these concepts together show that federal law is incorporated into state law. There's a few other provisions, Judge Daly, that I think show that federal law is incorporated in this instance. The Conservation Easement Statute, Section 522.3.5, says the executive director shall have the authority to accept or reject the validity of the credit based upon IRS and federal regulations. That's in the CE statute. 3922.102 says the department is to use federal judicial and administrative determinations and precedents when interpreting state law. That includes the separate taxable unit rule.
What statute is that?
3922.102. And then just one section over, Judge Daly, in 3922.103, subsection 11, it states due consideration shall be given to applicable sections of the Internal Revenue Code and to federal rulings and regulations interpreting those sections.
And what's the applicable federal statute or regulation in this context?
Here it's the statute of limitations. It's 26 U.S.C. 6501. And that statute says that any tax shall be assessed within 3 years after the return is filed. It's the return that is the operative event, and the department gets a specified amount of time to review the entire return, not discrete subparts of the return.
Is there a separate taxable unit rule actually in the text of the statute itself?
It's been interpreted by that language, and that's the Soonan case from the U.S. Supreme Court cited in our briefing. I think it's important to realize what the plaintiffs are asking for here. They're asking for a rule that adopts the federal separate taxable unit rule in part, but not in full, so that discrete parts of the return would be reviewable by the department, but not the whole return. That's just simply not what the General Assembly intended.
Well, I think that's the whole dispute here. Why is it that the General Assembly didn't intend it? This is a kind of a strange statute, as the district court indicated. Why can't there be an intent to do something different in this area?
I think 7i was intended to do something very specific, Your Honor. It was meant to deal with a specific problem. And that problem was the problem of late filing TMRs, late filing donors. We talk about this in our briefing when we discuss the Nichols case, which is a Jackson County District Court case that's still pending in District Court. There you had a late filing TMR. He didn't file his tax return generating the credit until 1 year after he was supposed to. So we had transferee claims filed in the year of transfer, properly filed, but the department had no ability to match that to a conservation easement donation. It wasn't until 1 year later the department was able to perform its matching function. I think what the General Assembly was intending was that the department gets 4 years from that late filing to review the entire return and to make corrections if necessary. I'd like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
I apologize to my colleagues for taking up so much of the time asking you questions and not allowing them to ask questions as well. I apologize.
Yes.
Good afternoon. Eric Vogt, registration number 34718, appearing on behalf of the petitioners. Asher Rittmiller is with me at the council table. The petitioners here are the donors of the conservation easements that are subject to this case. The petitioners transferred the credits that came from those conservation easements to a number of transferees. The district court held that the relationship between the specific Colorado state tax credit statute and the general statute of limitations for revenue statute requires revenue to disallow a conservation easement on the basis of validity and value, validity or value, within 4 years of the donor's return generating that conservation easement credit. Two other district court judges charged with hearing the hundreds of conservation easement cases have found exactly the same thing. And that's in the MedVed case and in the Farm Deals case, which we provided in our supplementation of the record. Our position, which was adopted by the district court, is that revenue has the ability to review and reject tax returns as usual, except in the case of issues related to validity and value in this particular state tax credit statute. The reasons for this exception is because the tax credit in question here in the tax credit statute is unique. It's unique because it's sellable. So you have a donor and a transferee. And because of this unique feature, the General Assembly and revenue had to pass and promulgate specific statutory sections and specific regulations that govern this unique relationship. When a donor goes to donate a conservation easement, Colorado law requires the donor to provide a mountain of information related to validity and value of its easement to the Department of Revenue with its initial return. This includes a summary of appraisal related to the value and how they calculate that. It includes The conservation easement deed, which provides detailed information about the validity impact. He's required to also provide a Form 8283 and a Form 1305, which provide additional information. The transferee, when the transferee goes to use the credit that it bought years later, that return provides zero information about validity and value. My bet is the transferee doesn't even know where the property is located that generated this tax credit. They just bought this credit from some broker. They provide no more information about validity and value. When revenue gets this credit, or gets the donor's return, they can ask for additional information about validity and value. That's section 3.5. They can force the donor to get another appraiser regarding the value of the conservation easement credit.
What's their incentive to do so, though, when if I'm claiming but not using a credit in that first year, what's their incentive, the department's incentive, to actually review that? What do we care? It's not going to affect the tax assessment that year or in subsequent years until it's used.
Number one, because the legislator has told them to go forward and do that, and the legislator has said that the statute of limitation of the transferee is the same as the donors.
That may be true, but in other words, you're saying that that's an indication that it commences upon the claim, not necessarily upon years later use.
Right. And I think the legislative history bears this out. In 2005, Section 3.5 came into existence, which gave them the right to go after the donor's return, gave them the authority to audit the donor's return for validity and value. That's also when 7I and 7J came into play, that said the statute of limitations for the transferee is the same as the donor. And lo and behold, it was revenue that went to the legislature and said, hey, we need to be able to audit this initial return. Otherwise, it gets spread out to all these transferees, maybe 50 different transferees, which use it in up to years 20. And so the legislature said, okay, we'll go forth, and you thought you had the authority, but go forward and audit the donor's return.
And that's in 3.5, it authorizes auditing the initial return where it's claimed?
It does. And that came about in 2005 when the bill was passed at their behest. So that transferred everything to the donor's return at their request. They said, we're not sure we can even audit the donor's return because there's not a tax consequence. So the legislature gave them that authority. So this has been debated and determined, and there's statutory sections that provide that. They also needed to make the statute of limitations the same because they wanted decisions in regard to the validity and value of the credit to be binding on the transferee. And to do that, you really need a statute of limitations that's the same. And that's the genesis for all these changes. And why they want to do this is because when it gets transferred out to these transferees, now you've got maybe, I've seen them with 50 transferees that bought credits from one conservation easement. The legislator has continually said, audit that initial return so we don't have this problem anymore. Today, in 2014, the statute says that the donor has to go get a certification from the real estate division that says that validity and value are okay before they can even donate the return or donate the conservation easement. So the legislature has made it clear over and over again that go audit this return within 4 years. So council is correct. It runs from a return. There's no dispute about how long the statute of limitations in general is for revenue. It's 4 years. There's no dispute that it was 4 years in this case. There was no federal audit, and there's no tolling of the statute of limitations. The only issue is what return does it run from? And the statutory language in I and J make it clear that it runs from the donor's return for issues like validity and value. Revenue also passed after this 2005 amendment, adding 3.5 and the same statute of limitations. Revenue went out in 2006 and passed a bunch of regulations regarding the statute of limitations. Here's what they say. The statute of limitations of the transfer or and any extension of the statute of limitations agreed to by the TMR will also apply to the transferees of the credit, but only to the extent that it applies to the transfer item adjustments. So you look up, what does that mean? And the transfer item adjustments are validity and value and the appraisal. And then the catch-all is anything that affects, anything in regard to the credit that affects both the transferee and the donor. We know that these conservation easements at issue were audited and disallowed for value and validity reasons. So we know it's a transfer item adjustment. We know that, therefore, it runs from the donor's return. We're not saying that illegal use of the credit can't be audited within 4 years of the transferee's return, because that's not a transfer item adjustment. Say the transferee uses twice as many credits as he got from the donor. Well, that doesn't affect the donor. That's a use issue. That's not validity, value, or something that affects them both. That's a use issue, and they have 4 years.
Is there a definition of transfer item adjustment?
Yes, in the revenues regulations, and that is in the statutory or the regulatory sections. You should look under our section 3, small j, small 1, small 2, and then small 7, I think. Maybe I'm not giving that correct, but we've cited them in our briefs over and over again. So the language is so clear that in MedVed and in farm deals, they argue that the statutory language is clear and unequivocal, that the donor's or the transferee's statute of limitations is the same as the donor's. They argued that, and they won in those cases. There, it was the transferee filed first, donor filed second, and the Department of Revenue didn't disallow on validity and value grounds within 4 years of the transferee, but within 4 years of the donor. They easily said, well, the clear statutory language requires the transferee's statute of limitations to be the same as the donor's. Now, for the first time on appeal, recall they never cite to the tax credit statute at all down below. For the first time on appeal, they make the distinction and say, there's this linkage. This statutory language that's clear in 7i and 7j only appears in the statutory books when you have this year linkage. Otherwise, that ink disappears for all other years. That is not a reading that this court can give to 7i and 7j, because it renders meaningless for all years but that year linkage, which again, linkage doesn't appear anywhere in the statute. It renders those sections meaningless. It renders the section in the regulations about transfer item adjustments meaningless for all years but the year of linkage. There is also no separate tax lien rule in general in federal law. It's based on the federal statutes that create the credits that are carried forward, or the deductions that are carried forward, or the deductions that are carried back. That's what the courts look at, and if the statute allows it, that's when they can go recalculate in a prior year. There's no authority that says Colorado would adopt that rule for any taxable credit or deduction. It cannot adopt that rule in this case. What they say is when the transferee uses the credit or part of the credit in year 10, they get 4 years to audit that return. And to do so, they can go back to year 0 and recalculate the donor's return. What our statute says for validity and value issues, you must do your recalculation within 4 years of the donor's return. There's no room for the federal taxable, separate taxable unit rule in this statute. I don't know if it could be applied in other Colorado taxing statutes, but it can't be applied in this statute. One thing that I really want to mention is there's a lot of talk about how Colorado always incorporates federal ruling on tax into their state tax code. And I think the section that has been cited, but it hasn't been quoted in its entirety, is, by revenue, is, the section 3922-103-11, subsection 11. They leave out the part about, here's the full thing, due consideration shall be given in interpretation of this article, the article is the state income tax code, to applicable sections of the Internal Revenue Code in effect from time to time, and to federal rulings and regulations interpreting such sections, if such statute rulings, federal rulings, and regulations do not conflict with the provisions of this article. As I just discussed, there's a direct conflict, even if Colorado would adopt a separate tax per unit rule with this particular tax credit statute. And Colorado statute says that you can't apply those federal rulings when there's a direct conflict. I will also say that revenue never raised deference. They never raised the tax credit, the Colorado's tax credit statute. They never even cited to it in their briefs below. They never raised deference in their briefs below. The statute is clear, they're not entitled to deference.
Well, I was going to say, if the statute is clear, it's not entitled to deference. If the statute's unclear, are we supposed to disregard an applicable rule of statutory interpretation?
And
if the statute is unclear, are we to disregard an applicable rule of statutory interpretation merely because it was not cited below?
No, Your Honor, and I would say that the statutory rule of interpretation that you would, if any, that you would use here, first of all, you wouldn't because it's clear language, but if you were going to use one, it would be that a specific statute always takes precedent against a conflicting general statute. The rule of statutory interpretation and giving deference to an agency doesn't apply if it's clear. It doesn't apply if they don't ask for it down below at the district court level. And it doesn't apply if they interpret that statute in inconsistent ways, which they have here with farm deals and the MedVed case.
Are those district court cases, did you say?
They are district court.
Are they binding on us?
No, but it shows that they interpreted this law inconsistently.
Well, let me ask you, were those part of the record?
How would yes, I know about that? I supplemented the record with those cases.
And let me ask you, can you supplement the record with decisions of other courts?
I sure thought we could because that's why I did it, but maybe I'm wrong.
Usually the record is what was before the court at the time.
I didn't get an objection from the other side, so I thought it was good.
So, all right,
I'm counsel. Out of time. I think you should affirm the district court's ruling.
Thank you for your argument.
I'd like to hit three main points in rebuttal. We heard some discussion about subsection 3.5, 522, 3.5. 3.5, again, it incorporates many parts of federal law, but it also, in the last sentence of 3.5A, it incorporates other provisions of Colorado law, including 3921-103, which is the statutory protest procedure. So 3.5, I believe, because it incorporates 3921-103, the protest procedure, it contemplates a live dispute about the amount of owed tax. Absent a live dispute about the amount of owed tax, there is no right to a hearing. The statute of limitations is not commenced.
Let me ask you this. In this case, with all three of them, there was a live dispute, wasn't there? Because not only did they claim the credit, but they used the credit that first year. Why wouldn't there have been a live dispute about the amount of tax?
There was a live dispute for the uses of the credit for tax year 2004, but those were only small.
2005 and 2006 and 2007 and 2008.
Yes, but each one of those years commenced its own statute of limitations period for that particular return.
So, counsel, you're saying that DRO can go back and look again at validity and value for each one of those years every time a new tax return is filed?
Yes, Your Honor. That's what the separate taxable unit says. But again, it's limited to the amount of taxes that were the amount of tax credit used on that return just 4 years earlier. If the return uses in year 20 $50,000 of tax credit, it's limited to that $50,000 of tax credit when it's conducting its review up to year 24. It can't go back to year one and review tax use tax credit use from year one through all the way through year 19.
But you could go back 4 years and still question the validity of the conservation easement tax credit or the value of it? Every time there's a tax return filed.
The separate taxable unit rule allows the department to go back 4 years and review the entirety of that return. And if there's conservation easement credit use generated from a donation 20 years earlier, then yes, they can review that credit use from 4 years prior. There's not a 24-year statute of limitations. It's 4 years from when the credit was used.
But let me ask you, Council, isn't one of the purposes of the conservation easement credit statute, and in particular the transfer part, to be able to provide some type of cash relief to people who might be land rich and cash poor?
I do believe that is one of the purposes.
Well, let me ask you the next question. Is that okay? If one of the way you relieve that is to sell your credits, isn't that create a disincentive for transferees to buy those credits if 20 years down the line they're subject to challenge?
You're leading me into exactly my second point on rebuttal, Your Honor, and I see I'm almost out of time.
No, you get your response.
I hope you're letting me indulge me here. In 2013, there was a Senate bill run and passed and signed by the governor. It's Senate Bill 13-221, and it changed the process for this review process. It created a pre-certification process. And in that legislative declaration, it said exactly that, Your Honor. It says, we want to help ensure timely review of these tax credits and eliminate the uncertainty for taxpayers and transferees. So the General Assembly recognized that this was a problem, and it took action to fix this problem. But if plaintiff's interpretation is correct, that validity and value close in year four, this problem that the General Assembly sought to solve would have been non-existent.
Did you cite this 2013 Senate bill?
Yes, Your Honor. It's in a footnote in our reply brief.
Okay.
So again, I think that if plaintiff's interpretation is correct, that validity and value closed very, very early on in the process, and the department is deprived from looking at validity and value, then this problem sought to be solved by the General Assembly would not have existed.
And so, did they enact that bill?
They did, and it was signed by the governor. So today, if you're trying to claim a conservation easement tax credit, you file all your paperwork, and then the Conservation Easement Site Oversight Commission issues a certificate. Prior to the issuance of the certificate, there is no conservation easement tax credit. So the General Assembly saw that this was a problem and took action to correct it. We ask that you vacate the district court's judgment and remand for trial.
Could I ask one more question? I know that we're going on.
Absolutely.
Why would the department want to look at and determine validity and value more than once?
This is addressed in the Soonan case, Your Honor, the U.S. Supreme Court's Soonan decision cited in our briefing. Ideally, they do not. However, the department is not allowed to issue advisory opinions on unused tax credits. That's something they can't do, just like this court can't issue an advisory opinion. However, the doctrine of collateral estoppel discussed in the Soonan case may do away with the need for a second hearing. When unused credit becomes used credit, if it's disallowed, now we have a second protest about largely the same issues. If the underlying facts are the same, if there's no intervening legal developments, the doctrine of collateral estoppel may dispense with the need for having that second hearing. But no, the department cannot issue advisory opinions on unused credits.
So when the credits are used and the department makes a determination as to the value of the easement credit, tax credits, it's determining whether or not the appraisal was correct. Is that right? That's one of the things it's determining.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why would it have to make that determination again at a later date?
I don't think it does.
Under a different tax return.
I don't think it does, Your Honor. However, in this case, for tax year 2004, there wasn't that determination. The department admits that it missed the statute of limitations deadline for tax year 2004. So there was no determination about validity or value. The department did set out to make that determination for tax year 2005, and it did so timely as to tax year 2005.
Okay, it did as far as 2005. Now you have a transferee that then files a tax return in 2020. Under your argument, the department can again review the validity and value of the conservation easement tax for credits, right?
I think it can under limited circumstances, and this again is an assuming case. Perhaps there was an intervening legal development, a Colorado Supreme Court case about appraisal practice, about, you know, if there's been a large new development in the area of tax compliance, if there's a change in the law, then yes, the department might need to hold a second hearing because of the change in the law.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, and I apologize for...
No, no, you're good.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. You're not done yet, though. No, no. Have a seat. No, no, no. Have a seat. Have a seat.
Okay.
This is going to be really different. We're going to do something I've never seen done in this court. I would like opposing counsel to address the effect of 2013 Senate Bill 221, and then I'm going to give you a chance to respond to what opposing counsel has said, and then that will be it. But the subjects are limited to 2013 Senate Bill 221.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you both for indulging me.
I'd like to address the
Senate Bill 221.
Oh, that's it? Okay. So, as I said, this bill requires the donor to get a certificate from the real estate commission before it can file for a state tax credit. That bill passed long after we donated our conservation easement and long after it has been disallowed. It has no effect on this particular case. I believe that it shows an ongoing intent from the General Assembly to continue to push to the donor's return decisions of validity and value.
Why would it have been necessary, though, if your construction of the statute is correct?
Because I think what they wanted to do was to have the Real Estate Commission, who has the expertise in regard to these difficult conservation easement valuations, to take a look at this. You see in the legislative history, one of the problems they really had is Redmond kept saying to the General Assembly, we don't have the expertise to say what the value of these conservation easements are. So I think that was the real impetus, get the folks with the knowledge involved before this donation has been made and give a sort of a pre-certification of these things by the folks and the Real Estate Commission.
Thank you.
It has nothing to do with our case. It only limits our case, I suppose.
Thank you, counsel.
I just looked at the briefing. It is cited on page 13 of our reply brief, so we alerted the court to the existence of this new law. I disagree with my colleague. I think that the purpose that the General Assembly had when enacting Senate Bill 221 was it recognized that this was a problem. They wanted to give taxpayers more certainty in dealing with their conservation easement tax credits, and they wanted to ensure a timely review of the validity and value of the conservation easement itself. And that was accomplished through Senate Bill 221. But if their position is correct in this case, that validity and value close in year four, then this problem would not have existed. The General Assembly would not have taken action to fix this problem.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
I want to thank both counsel for their excellent arguments in this case and for putting up with a couple of unusual procedures as well. Thank you both for your arguments in the case. The case will stand submitted and opinion will issue in due course. Thank you both very, very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.